From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's entertaining and accessible. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. Today in the program, we start by talking about design thinking with several designers who collaborate on innovation within PayPal. It's Darwin Liu and Parker Gunsel. They are several of the speakers who will be in Park City next week for the Thin Air Festival.
Good morning, Lynn, and welcome back. Great to have you here again.
Thank you.
Then it's more innovation and keeping up with it. You know, some cool stories about the biggest taxi company in the world that owns no cars, the biggest hotel company in the world that owns no hotels, and other cool stories. Then we're going to speak with Josh Hobson from the March for Science in Park City. Nice little parade coming, not parade, but a gathering and a parade, I guess you could call it, coming to town in April.
It's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch Counties.
Hi, I'm Dr. Renato Saltz, proud to support KPCW. At Saltz Plastic Surgeons Pa Vitoria, we offer cosmetic surgeries of the face and body, as well as non-surgical procedures such as CoolSculpting, laser resurfacing, Botox, and fillers. More information at saltzplasticsurgery.com or 655-6612.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Well, have you heard the term design thinking and wondered what it is? Well, it's a way of thinking indeed, but also a way of creatively collaborating that many innovative companies are regularly practicing to create the best solutions for what they do. Design thinking is about experimentation, wayfinding, prototyping, and constant iterations. Design thinking draws upon logic, imagination, intuition, and systemic reasoning, exploring possibilities of what can be. Two of these leading design thinkers will join us now by phone. Darwin Liu is a manager in the advisory services practice of Ernst & Young, specializing in digital strategy, transformations, and product innovation. This includes leading the design thinking transformation at PayPal. Now, he has done some collaboration at PayPal along with Parker Gunsel. Parker is an award-winning product designer. He's led teams within some of the most respected design studios worldwide at Samsung, T-Mobile, and PayPal. And now he's at Uber, where he visually demonstrates the value that Uber creates for their riders and drivers. We're pleased that they could join us for Cool Science Radio. Parker and Darwin, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Lynn. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, great to have you. Darwin, why don't we start with you? Can you talk a little bit more about design thinking? In a sense, it's an old term. There is a famous video used regularly in leadership conferences of a group of people back in the 80s at IDEO. And I think they were practicing the first design thinking, which I think we used to call brainstorming, but collaboration among people with different sets of skills and expertise. Is that kind of how you look at it?
Oh, that's just one part of it, Lynn. I think the bigger part of it is really putting the customer first and really talking to the folks that you are serving. And not only is that important for the designers, but for the whole team. And so when you mention collaboration, it's bringing everybody into that whole journey to understand exactly what it is that you're building, who it's for, and what pain points they encounter throughout the time that they're using your product.
So I think this is a world that is a bit foreign to those of us that aren't working for companies like Uber and PayPal. And so I'd like to hear about the collaboration that you two have done in the past and what you've been working on. Part of this is what you're bringing to Park City next week. Parker, can you talk a little bit about what you've done together?
Sure. So during our time at PayPal, Darwin and I were really focused on moving away from just being a optimized focus type of org, and how can we be more innovative and think about what's coming next, and how can we think about these next products and features and actually build something to get in front of users and try that out. And so Darwin and I would come together with some other colleagues of ours and kind of imagine some future products that we could maybe be doing at PayPal, and then start to actually make and design them in really scrappy ways to kind of get them out there.
Fascinating. When people come to Thin Air to listen to your talks, what can they expect to hear?
Well, I can start there, Parker. So I think the number one thing is that innovation is not by accident. You really have to plan for it and create the culture that really supports that. Number two is that it really does not need to be a very expensive endeavor to get started. It's not this huge mountain to climb just to get over the top. And number three is it's not the responsibility of one person or one small department. Everyone can have a part in that.
Okay. And Darwin, that was you. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Parker, you want to add to that?
Yeah. So one thing that is a big part of my practice is prototyping, and specifically something called Wizard of Oz prototyping, which gets its name from the famous scene in the movie The Wizard of Oz, where Dorothy sort of pulls back the curtain and reveals that this big, powerful thing and experience that they thought they were seeing was really faked all the time. So Wizard of Oz prototyping to me is something that I try to share with an entire org or my team to kind of get on this really scrappy way of prototyping an idea quick and fast, but using really cheap and efficient ways of getting to that idea and make it tangible and interactive and try to get in front of as many people to get some feedback quickly.
So give us a for example, when you talk about quick and efficient and cheap ways of prototyping, are you talking about a certain tangible product and then you're building a prototype on the desk in front of you with, I don't know, cardboard?
Yeah, so actually, so my favorite example is the Nest thermostat. So it's an Internet of Things, new thermostat that's connected to the Internet and you can control it from your smartphone. And so think about 6 years ago, before that came out in the market, let's say you and I came up with this idea, we wanted to test it or build it. Well, instead of spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on a electronic circuit board, high-designed model that you could then put on the wall and try out, what if you could take some foam core and cut a hole in it and using a smartphone or an Apple Watch make an interactive flow where you could test out this idea and so sort of make a little model using, like you said, cardboard or even just a smartphone, put it on the wall, put it in front of people, and actually walk them through this experience or the story that you're trying to tell. And so that's why I've been leading a workshop the last couple of years at various companies teaching anybody and everybody how to become this prototyping superhero. And you can do this in about a half hour or less with minimal cost of tools and materials lying around.
Do you wear a cape when you talk about being the superhero prototyping?
I don't, but I want to give everybody that superpower that anybody can be a prototyper. It's not just up to developers or designers, but really anybody can have this sort of superpower in their toolkit when they're making or designing.
Yeah, I'll never look at my Nest the same way again. And so what I'm sort of understanding is that you start with sort of the finished product, the vision for how you want the end consumer to look at it and to feel about it when they look at it, which is a big component of what you do. And then you sort of go backwards from there. Would that be right?
Actually, not necessarily. So prototyping really helps you evolve your idea and get to that final design. So it's all about testing and iterating. So the quicker that you can try something out, throw it away, and then try something else out, the better that the end product will be.
Yeah, let me
Yeah,
just added a little something there. This is Darwin. Talking about ideating on future concepts, it's really hard to really show people what you're thinking about without something that they can tangibly touch and feel. And so a lot of times, even in the early concepting phase, we'll put something really quick and simple out there just so people can get a better idea of what it is we're talking about.
You kind of have to prime the pump, and throwing stuff away, of course, is a good thing to do. You just need to start generating ideas as quickly as you can, and get people with their creative juices starting to provide input. Is that correct?
Yeah. If I could interject, so the value of prototyping is that you can build something and then put it in front of people, but the prototypes themselves aren't valuable. It's the learning from them.
Right.
So most prototypes, they should be like kind of thrown away, and that's how you can iterate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have to ask you, just off topic for a moment, did both of you gentlemen have an opportunity to work with Elon Musk?
Not directly.
Not yet.
PayPal, we're heavily influenced by a lot of his thinking.
Right. Okay. Because we've all worked for senior management teams before, and I was wondering if there was anything that you could see that was unique about his approach or the way he managed.
From my perspective, it's just his approach to first principles, and that's something that we took a look at a few years back with our checkout process. And this is something I'm going to talk about a little bit in a little more detail at Thin Air. It is really going back to first principles about the checkout process and how to reinvent that.
And the checkout process is so clean; it's so easy. If you're used to plugging in your credit card numbers and things like that, and you have a PayPal button and you have a PayPal account, it's so much easier just to click on that and to go. Was that part of it?
Actually, that came after that. Even with our earlier checkout products, there were a few extra things in there. But because that generates so much revenue for the company, nobody wanted to make any drastic moves on the checkout flow. Then one day, David Marcus said, hey, what if we reimagine checkout? What would that look like? So instead of tweaking, we just basically kind of threw everything aside and started from scratch.
Interesting. Yeah.
We're speaking with Darwin Louie and Parker Gunsel, and they are award-winning product designers. They collaborate on various projects, one of those being with PayPal. They're coming to Park City next week to speak at the Thin Air Festival. And Parker, I believe it was you. I wanted to ask you a question about Uber, because you're now at Uber, I believe. Is that right?
Yes. Yep, for the last 4 months.
Okay, great. So it sounds like you're a little bit of everywhere, which is kind of what you do with your Wizard of Oz prototyping. But I'm thinking about those people who are late adapters to innovative companies and things that come right before us, like Uber, that once you take the step into calling it up your first Uber car, you realize how easy, how intuitive, and it is, and you ask yourself, why did I never do this before? Now, is there a portion of what you do that is also that step before? Because obviously you've worked to make these processes so attractive to the consumer that they say, wow, I'm never going to call a real taxi again. This is so easy. My question is about that step to get you there for those late adopters. Is that something that you work on?
So if I'm understanding your question, you're asking about the people that come later, not the early adopters or the
right.
masses, but the ones at the trail end of it.
You know, my mom, for example.
Yeah. So another part in, I guess, the design thinking world is if you can design for the extremes, the middle works itself out. And so if you focus on early adopters or people with pain points or problems at the extremes, The 80% in the middle will sort of work itself out and definitely come to your product or your thing that you just created. So I think one example of this was Ford back in the day when they first were looking at a very, very small little hatchback. They were interviewing children and elderly, and they found that elderly had certain problems with reaching over their shoulder and getting a seatbelt from behind. So they came up with a better door design, door handle that was much thicker and easier to pull towards you, and a seatbelt that came from in front of you. And so focusing on extremes like that, that's going to work for everyone. So I think if that's one kind of strategy to go at when designing and thinking about products.
Right. That's a good one. So wondering, Darwin, you talk a little bit, you sent me a couple links to some things that you've worked on regarding, I call them fonts, but you call them something else.
It was our type stack. So
okay.
A couple years ago, we were looking at all aspects of design over at PayPal and trying to squeeze every last bit of design craftsmanship into the experiences. And at the center of our experiences was the font. And we basically thought about what it would mean to actually express ourselves a little bit differently than everybody else in the industry. Being that PayPal was very numbers focused, we wanted to be seen as the unbank or the non-bank. And so we want to be humanist. So we want to capture a lot of these qualities into a font that really allows us to show a lot of numbers and a little bit of text in smaller fonts that are just as readable as larger fonts for other companies. And so that would give us an advantage, especially when we're going to phones, mobile devices, and even wearables.
Hmm. Parker, for our listeners at home that may own a business or a piece of a business that are thinking of reinventing portions of that, what advice would you give them?
Just experiment a lot and often, and definitely try to get in front of your customers or users and as much as possible. So go where they're at and go show them your ideas and get feedback early and often. And that'll really help you progress your idea and get something that they actually want and need.
Do you believe that if you have a product that the consumer will have, that it has to be accessible by the iPhone or by smartphones, those sorts of things? Is that basically the future?
I think right now it's an easy way to get to a mass market since they're pretty ubiquitous these days. And the smartphone market's pretty saturated, like everybody has one, or at least one smart device. So if you did want to come up with some kind of connected product or service, it's the easy front door to that customer or the rest of their like social sphere account.
Okay.
Yeah. Interestingly, more people have smartphones than they do have bank accounts. And so obviously in the space that we were in at PayPal, that was an easy way to reach out to a new customer base that was not being served.
Yeah. So I want to ask you too about, last month or maybe the month before, we talked to two guys at Stanford who teach apparently the most popular class at Stanford. It's called Designing Your Life, and it's about applying design thinking to your life. Bill Burnett and Dave Evans, both Stanford professors, great guys. It was very interesting to take this concept. You know, they both worked in the industrial design department at Stanford, and they take this design thinking and apply it to your life. And I'd like for each of you, maybe starting with Darwin, to talk about that. Your experience in your career and your profession with design thinking, and how you carry it through every step of your life, whether you're at the grocery store checkout lane or whatever it is.
Well, that's a very interesting question. Just because I was not always a design person, in the last 7 years, I've learned quite a bit about design, and now everything I look at, I take a look at with a different lens and think about what thought process went into actually creating that. Because as you know, everything in the world has been designed, just not everything is designed well. And so definitely when I take a look at things that are out there, I think about how it can be improved. And that's really what got my start into the innovation side of things, is how do we improve on products and experiences that we have now?
Okay, that's good. I like that. So what was your background then if you weren't in design?
Product and technology.
Okay. And Parker, how about you?
For me, it's design thinking sort of focused at these three things of discovering, designing or inventing, and then making or delivering something. So if you think of the first discovery learning part, that's observing whether it's a current experience you're having at a restaurant or a conversation you're having with somebody, and then just pulling out like what in that you're noticing is either broken or wrong or that could be improved, and then getting inspired by that and then thinking through like possible ideas.
Yeah, okay. So let's take that experience at a restaurant. So you're sitting there and you think, okay, the waiter comes or the server comes and takes my order and then has to walk all the way back across the restaurant to put it into the computer. And while he or she is doing that, two other tables stop them and ask them where their wine is that they ordered 10 minutes ago. And so it just slows down the process versus if they can be at the table with this little computer, this smart thing in their hand, and they can just punch in your order right then. It goes right to the kitchen and the whole process is made. And the dining experience, therefore, is made much better. That sort of thing, right?
Yeah, you've sort of seen it with the iPads at the dinner table for the wine list. And I think a lot of restaurants, when they first introduced that, they noticed an uptick in wine sales because it wasn't just from people using the iPad. It was more that other tables would notice some table had an iPad and they were picking out wine and they wanted to also have that experience. So they demanded to have the iPad and then order some wine off of it. So they actually saw, I think, an uptick in sales from just introducing that new way of ordering wine at the table.
Lynn, that's a great example because nobody wants their wine to be late. 10 minutes, that's a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
We just don't want that. What other thoughts do you both have about the future of design automation and how that's going to be incorporated into businesses?
Well, I think design and product are really joined at the hip, and so you can't have a great product without great design and great experience. Over at PayPal, that's one of the things I really push for, is really understanding that it doesn't matter how well thought out your use cases are or how solid your technology is, if people can't find your products, can't use it, can't complete flows, the product's going to fail.
Exactly. Well, fascinating conversations, we're looking forward to having you out here for Thin Air. What's your perspective on Thin Air? It's kind of a new thing for Park City. We did it last year. This is our second year.
I'm really super excited about the mix of it.
Yeah.
Great. Sorry we had you answering on top of each other. But Darwin, do you know your schedule for Thin Air, or is it something we ought to look at the website for?
Yes. So on Thursday, Park and I will be speaking, I think, at 3 o'clock as part of a tail end of a panel discussion. And I think Parker is doing a return engagement, or actually a kind of a follow-on on Friday afternoon.
I would imagine, Parker, when you're doing your Wizard of Oz prototyping and talking through the 30 minutes that you are helping companies see how they can apply it, you often get the question or the statement, you know, this just isn't going to apply to my, you know, accounting firm. What do you say to that? And does this apply, in your opinion, to every company out there?
I really feel it does, because ideas can come from anywhere and from anywhere in your org. So think of that person in HR or on a legal team or some product ops person that doesn't fancy themselves as a designer or an inventor, or they don't know how to code, but they have some great idea. And if you had this toolkit that your entire company-wide could use, and they were each giving, you know, you had 1,000 employees and they each came up with an idea, at least one of those is going to be a game changer and could really impact your business going forward. So that's kind of the superpower I want to give to everybody in a company.
I love it. That's really great. So I have to ask both of you, no doubt you, as you say, you view all of life and existence through this design thinking lens. What are the things that make you most crazy that you see going on that you just say, oh, if only, you know, they had this sort of thing that would make this process better? Are there little pet peeves that you see as you go through your day, Darwin?
Plenty, but there are a lot of those ideas are in the patent pipeline right now, so I can't discuss them. But like I mentioned, everything out there has been designed by someone, and a lot of times it kind of leaves me in awe or shock that somebody would actually let something go out into production without fully thinking through the interactions.
Yeah. And how about you, Parker?
Sure. So for me, you know, if you look at how the world's changed with social networks like Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, and companies are really connecting with their customers in new ways on all these different platforms, I think the next wave of listening on that sort of platform is then engaging them and letting them try things a lot earlier, so you can bring them along your journey of building this product instead of building it in a vacuum and then launching it and see how it does.
Absolutely. I mean, so many of us, even those of us who are not in innovative careers like you guys and thinking about design, how often have we said in our lives, oh, this is really poorly designed? And I think that it comes from, as you say, having worked in vacuums, not thinking through all of the types of users that might be using this. And so much about, I think, that we talk a lot about this on this show is how we're no longer operating in silos, that we're recognizing the expertise of other people and their skills and what they can bring to our idea, whereas in the past we may have viewed it as somewhat of a threat, or, you know, taking my idea and changing it enough that it's no longer my idea. And would you say that that just doesn't exist anymore, Parker?
No, it still exists in some corners. Like, you'll have a not invented here attitude of certain teams that might be competing. You know, some companies have those kind of cultures, but the best companies have ones where you can, ideas can come from anywhere again, and it's okay to step on someone's toes in the way of suggesting an idea or putting it out there, and then coming together and collaborate on the best possible solution.
Darwin, I'm curious. Products can be patented and protected for the capabilities that the products provide and how they get there. But how about flow and process? Can that be intellectual property? Can that be protected?
Of course, those things can be protected. Interactions can be protected. Anytime that you want to have something that's exclusively yours, whether it's, like I said, process, product, just even ideas that are not fully fleshed out, there are ways to protect for that.
And was Uber able to do that, or did Lyft look at this a different way, or is it sort of the same process in the way that people are able to arrange for a ride?
I'll let Parker take
products themselves, if they have something that's really novel that hasn't been done before, you can either try to patent that, or if your process and method is so unique and it's really better for your company to keep it internal, then you can also keep it as a trade secret. So I think things like team process and internal way of like working and coming up with designs, that sometimes would not be as patentable as like the actual thing that you ship that solves a problem in a unique way.
Right.
All right.
That being said, it is kind of tougher to patent something like ride sharing. But if there was an advanced algorithm that Uber uses to find the closest driver to minimize the wait time, that's something that can be easily protectable.
Of course. Of course. And Parker, just quickly off on the side, have you had an opportunity to experience any of the autonomous cars yet?
You know, I haven't. I've seen a couple of them when we first put them on the streets in San Francisco, but I haven't gotten to see in one yet myself.
Yeah,
but it's exciting times for sure, and it's really cool to see where we're going with it.
And it'll be sooner than later. It is very exciting.
Definitely.
Well, you guys, you must love your jobs. You have enviable positions. You were probably born in an enviable decade, which is great. And we're really excited that you're coming to Park City next week, and you'll be at the Thin Air Festival. So if you're listening to this interview and say you're a restaurant owner, or you've got a construction company, or as I said before, an accounting firm, and you find this to be interesting, you're bound to gather something. The general public can come to this, just to your talk. Is that right?
Yes, I think tickets are still available for the whole festival. I think it's going to be a lot of great learning experiences for everyone.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's Darwin Louie along with Parker Gunzel. And thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Hope to see you next week.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we are proud to support KPCW. With our new 352 Main Street entrance, the Spur now features three bars serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Lynn and I also wanted to mention that if you wanted to get more information on the Thin Air Conference that will be starting next Wednesday and buttoning up on Friday, you can go to Thin Air Park City and just Google that and you'll be able to get more information. Two gentlemen we just spoke with will be doing their discussion on Thursday at 3 p.m. of next week. Well, we've been talking about innovation and great design, and it makes us both think about a collection of innovation stories that we've collected from a variety of sources, and we'd like to share some of those. And it's really about the historical pace of change, change that has occurred in the past, change that could occur in the future. And I just thought I'd throw this out to start, Lynn, I guess.
Yeah.
In 1998, Kodak had 170,000 employees and sold 85% of all photo paper worldwide. Within just a couple of years, their business model disappeared and they went bankrupt. And what happened to Kodak could happen, will happen in a lot of industries in the next 5 to 10 years. And a lot of people won't see it coming. And did you think in 1998 that a couple of years later you wouldn't be able to ever take film pictures again? And it didn't happen overnight, as this whole technology thing works. Digital cameras were invented 25 years earlier than the year 2000 in 1975. And the early ones had 10,000 pixels, but, you know, following Moore's law, exponential technologies, it was a disappointment in the beginning if you looked at the price and what you got for it. But over time, it became superior and, of course, mainstream as it is today. And that Kodak example, I guess we could apply to future technologies, artificial technology, health, autonomous and electric cars, education, 3D printing, and all sorts of things, Lynn.
That's right. And did you know, I learned this recently, and I don't have the date, but Kodak had invented, someone at Kodak, a digital camera before anyone else, and they shelved it. Mm. They shelved it. They said, no, we have such a good thing going here with print film. We are going to keep bringing in the bucks. We're not going to, because we'll lose so much if we introduce a digital camera. And then by the time they entered the marketplace with their digital camera, it was too late.
That's an excellent example, because that's that, and we've talked about this before in the past, that freight train, the future, is running and no one's going to stop it.
That's right. Software also will disrupt most traditional industries in the next 5 to 10 years, as it has done the last 5 to 10 years. Uber, as we were talking about, it's really just a software tool. They don't own any cars, but they're now the biggest taxi company in the world. And that goes also for a company like Airbnb. It's now the biggest hotel company in the world, although they don't own any properties. And we all know that. But when you think really about the ramifications of that, it's pretty.
And it just happened. It just happened overnight.
I know. When was the first Uber that you took?
Well, it was 2 or 3 years ago, and probably 2 years ago. And it was because my kids said, hey, Dad, you got to try this thing out. You know, we listen to your podcast on Cool Science Radio, and we think that you're not hip enough. You need to get involved in this. So I tried it when I was in Boston visiting them.
That's right. Well, I only learned about it, I think it was two or three years ago that I heard about it for the first time. The first time I used it, I have to admit, was about a month ago. Now, granted, I don't visit big cities as often as you do, but I was back in Charlottesville for a conference in Virginia, and I used it for the first time, and I couldn't believe how easy it was. So yeah. There you go.
Yeah, you know, I still want to have the first autonomous car in Park City and maybe set up a little taxi service. And of course, there's, you know, we've talked about it on this program a bunch, but self-driving cars are going to start appearing in 2018 in the public. I mean, they're beta testing them right now in San Francisco and a couple of other cities. But in the early 2020s, around 2020, we're going to start to see a disruption where people won't necessarily have to own a car anymore. You'll call a car from a fleet of cars with your phone. It'll show up at your location and drive you to your destination. You're not going to need to park it. It'll drop you off and go and pick up the next rider. And you only pay for the driven distance, and you can be productive while driving. And the ramifications of that, one, is that it'll change cities because we'll need a lot less parking. They're calling for 90% to 95%. And a whole bunch of people, you know, will have their lives saved because where one accident occurs every 60,000 miles today, when autonomous cars are here, well, that will drop to one accident in 6 million. So save millions of lives per year.
There are quite a few upsides to innovation and technology. And then there are, you know, some things that we have to know are out there and going to happen that are negative. For example, most car companies becoming bankrupt. And just the tech companies, Tesla, Apple, Google, and how their approach, which is revolutionary, and it's that design thinking that we talked about, they'll end up building what essentially is a computer on wheels. Now, what's that do to engineers from Volkswagen and Audi? They're terrified of Tesla.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I was thinking about, my son was in town this past week, and we were having dinner, I think it was Sunday night, and we were talking about autonomous driving and what the industry, what it's going to do to insurance companies, to automobile companies, what it's going to do to children. Very young children of today will never get a driver's license. They may never own a car. And I told him a story that about a conversation that I had with my grandfather, who was born in 1890, and his first job required him to service these customers in these packing plants, and he did that on a horse and buggy. And he talked about the trade-offs. About he said he would never go to an automobile because it's crazy. Why would you do that? And, you know, things change.
That's right. Just like some now are saying they'll never go to electric cars, they'll become mainstream about the year 2020. Think of how cities will become less noisy because all new cars will run on electricity. And now electricity will become incredibly cheap and clean. Solar production, as we know, we're seeing more solar panels on houses. Right now, last year, more solar energy was installed worldwide than fossil. Now, energy companies desperately trying to hold back on that. We've seen some changes, some policy in our current administration just in the last couple of days trying to put the skids on. But as you say, the train has left the station. While they're trying to limit access to the grid to prevent competition from home solar installations. But technology will shine through and take care of that.
And this is in the news, Lynn, and I don't want to get political, but if you legislate against things to do to keep our environment clean or to help with the new climate to try to mitigate some of that with less CO2. If you legislate against that, it's not going to stop other countries from doing that. And it's not going to stop other countries from investing more in alternative energy technologies, and regardless of what this country does.
That's right. And jobs will go.
You're not going to stop that freight train.
That's right. Hey, let's talk briefly about 3D printing. Now, when you saw your first 3D printer, you couldn't believe what it made. And now the things that I hear 3D printers are making is just incredible. Some spare airplane parts are already, right now, 3D printed in remote airports. And the space station now has a printer that eliminates the need for the large amount of spare parts that they used to have in the past. Now, the price of the cheapest 3D printer came down from $18,000 to $400 just within 10 years, and it's become 100 times faster. How about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And all of the major sneaker companies are now testing and starting to provide technologies to their plant floors where they will be making 3D, they'll be printing shoes with 3D printers.
It's really hard to fathom.
It is. It is.
But cool.
It is.
And we have to think about this. We have to use that design thinking concept that our previous guest talked about as we move forward, because it's only going to help us, especially if we're late adopters, you know,
Because in the past, people that drove technology, they didn't include the design people in the collaboration of the product. You get them involved early, and you start thinking about how people will use the product and how to make it the most intuitive.
That's right.
It's interesting.
And soon that freight train you've been talking about becomes a Hyperloop.
Ooh.
Hey, should we go to take a quick break here before we welcome Josh Hobson on to talk about the March for Science?
You know, the first commercial Hyperloop link is going to be from Abu Dhabi to Dubai, and they're putting it in right now. So it'll be fascinating to, it's not just a test bed. It's going to be real.
And why isn't that first link here in the U.S.?
That is correct. And also some sheikh in Dubai put a stake in the ground and said that all transportation, 25% of all transportation will be autonomous by the year 2025. And they're going to have, starting mid-July, a helicopter autonomous drone that will pick you up and take you to your destination. It is a drone helicopter.
Wow.
I don't want to get in that one, though. Not yet.
Wouldn't it be amazing? Won't it be amazing if the China Bridge parking structure here in Old Town Park City, to which we are attached at KPCW, becomes obsolete and unused? We could tear it down and build a park.
Oh, I was thinking Costco.
Costco. There we go.
I'm only kidding.
It's definitely time to go to underwriting break.
I like the park side. Yeah.
It's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Josh Hobson to talk about Park City's March for Science taking place next month, the third week in April, when we return.
Hi, this is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers custom picture framing, rush options, hanging and delivery services, and in-house designers. Open Monday through Saturday, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. We now welcome our final guest to Cool Science Radio, Josh Hobson. He had a vision for stressing the importance of science, a concept that's never really come into question because it's science, until recent political climates have called widely accepted science into question. Now, while that's hopefully a passing fancy, it has inspired many around the globe to embrace the advances made in their work as we know it by the name of science. Josh has helped organize the local March for Science, be April 22nd, in Park City. It's a celebration of our passion for science and a call to support and safeguard the scientific community. He joins us in the studio. Josh, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me. And really, even just this week, evidence of our current administration reversing course on what I thought were modest directional, course changes. So But so there's plenty to talk about. But first, let's actually start. Since the last time I spoke to you, there has been a slight route change. We will still be starting at the Brewpub lot. We will gather at 9 o'clock that morning, start marching at 9:30. Essentially, in order to not close Heber Avenue, we're going to come at down Main Street, across the walkway in front of the Transit Center, and then back up Swede Alley to rally again at the Brewpub lot. But and there we're going to have a small a short slate of speakers, about 5 to 7 minutes each, and from there we're going to move then to the Sandy Auditorium, where we have a longer program. We have five local scientists who are all they're Utah scientists whose impact reaches well beyond Utah, and it just really I am really excited about some of the people we're getting. Dr. Chris Johnson, who's the founding director of the Scientific Computing and Imaging Institute down at the university. He's had TED Talks, Future in the Review Talks, Davos. And really, he is about visualizing big data and the applications of that in not just weather mapping, but the medical uses, just scientific research across the board has benefited from his work and the work of his institute. We have Dr. Rob Davies from Utah State coming, who's the state coordinator of the Utah Climate Change. I didn't write that down, but it really is regarded as one of the top climate scientists in the state. Dr. Rob McLeod from the Associate Director of the Nora Eccles Harrison Cardiovascular Research and Training Institute down at the university. And he is a scientist who spends his career educating scientists on how to talk about science to non-scientists. Like, he's just very compelling. All of these
Josh,
speakers,
you have a lot of enthusiasm. Yeah. I was going to say you'd have to come out of your shell because you're kind of shy. But he's a perfect guest. We don't even have to ask him any questions. I am curious. What is the genesis for this march? Is this going on in other locations in this country? How did all of this start for you?
Well, for me, it actually really started as I was walking to work from the Women's March. I really was trying to think of how can we keep the energy going? What can we do next? What are the issues that are important? And science was actually the first one to come in mind. And as I was talking to a couple of people over the following weeks, then the kind of what started as a march on Washington, and they had a set date of Earth Day, April 22nd, really it made a lot of sense to branch onto that. So we are actually one of five satellite marches here in Utah. There's one in Salt Lake, which I'll get back to in a moment. Logan, St. George, and Moab are all having marches. And in fact, the leaders of all five marches are going to be conferencing this Saturday to try to really get together and pull resources. It should be great.
Is it a national movement?
But yes, and there are we are one of 400 satellite marches around the country that day. So really, it is. I mean, while we don't expect here in Park City to have the crowd that the Women's March did nationally, crowd size might be similar. The groundswell is growing. People are really attracted to this idea because it really does touch all of our lives, whether we are scientists or not.
Right. Let me ask you this, and I'm not quite sure how to phrase the question, but do you really think there's an assault on science? I mean, yes, the current administration has sort of dialed back, well, has proclaimed, that climate change is not hard science, and has also dialed back some environmental measures, protection. But science in general, it's something that we as humanity have moved ahead so much because of science.
Absolutely.
Certainly, the administration is not discounting science as a whole.
Well, yes and no. Absolutely. Really, I do want this to be as much of a demonstration against what I perceive as going wrong. It is a celebration of science and all the advancements and how, just how research and technology have really improved our lives. But this morning, today is my brother's birthday. Among other things, he's a meteorologist, and he goes on storm chases throughout the Plain States, and was talking to him this morning about earthquakes in Oklahoma. And here we have, you know, Scott Pruitt as the head of the EPA, who, I mean, really ignores where those earthquakes are coming from, what the root cause, our activity, you know, I mean,
do you mean fracking?
Yeah, fracking. And I mean, my brother actually sent me this long list of there have been 23 3.0 or higher earthquakes in Oklahoma so far this year. I mean, that seems like a lot to me for, you know, a place without a fault line. I mean, while yes, absolutely, in our research institutes, in our universities, science is alive, science is well, you know, but we really do need politicians to both be making policy decisions based on actual verifiable data, but then more broadly, just make sure that the funding for this vital research is there, because, you know, when the kind of part of the climate change denial is then also saying, well, we don't really have to spend money worrying about that either. And yes, we do. You know, and, you know, it's, I think scientific research is one of those tremendously expensive things like defense and education that, you know, we as a society just need. And it is for the betterment of all of us. So, you know, again, I mean, I'm a chef. I use science at work all the time. You know, like mm-hmm. just a little bit of knowledge about heat transfer and bacteria growth makes my kitchen a safer place because, you know, like it doesn't really take, you know, I didn't need a master's degree in biology to understand that. It just takes a little bit of instruction, a little bit of, you know, knowledge, and, you know, it benefits all.
So, Lynn, just to add something to your question, the congressman in Washington that is the chair of the science committee who makes recommendations to the president, he is very gung-ho on NASA, so he supports NASA, but he just doesn't believe that CO2 in the air is being provided by us or that has anything to do with climate change. So I guess the government's kind of spotty. They've decided to defund, not defund, but give less funding to the National Institute of Health, which is very science and technology based. But, so the government is not against science. The government just sort of picks and chooses. And this is a biggie, CO2. And, it would be nice to have more support.
That's right. Let's talk about some more of the speakers that you have. And let me get this straight. I'm going to go through it again.
Yeah.
Meet at the Brew Pub Plaza at 9 a.m.
Correct.
And then you'll march down Main Street. You'll come through at the Bear Bench Plaza. Everyone yep. knows where the Bear Bench is. Come through to Sweet Alley, march back up Sweet Alley, and have some talks by a couple yep. of people at the Brew Pub Plaza, or the
yes.
Main Street Plaza, whatever they're calling it these days. And then you will get down, you'll go down to the Jim Santee Auditorium. Everyone's walking down,
exactly.
biking down, taking the bus down.
There's going to be about a 45-minute gap between, mm-hmm. you know, so everyone can make their way down there. And we are actually working on providing some food at the Santee Auditorium just to make sure people do actually come. We again have been talking with the Eccles. With Eccles, we want people to park out at the high school and bus in, just because, you know, it will be a crowd. Parking up here will be insane. Ride your bikes, walk. I mean, I live walking distance. I'm lucky enough, you know.
And quickly, a website people can go to.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Just, you know, search for March for Science Park City.
That sounds great. Josh Hobson, sorry we've run out of time. It's again April 22nd, 9 a.m. That's a Saturday morning.
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, KPCW supporter, providing personalized knee and shoulder care, focusing on cartilage restoration and joint resurfacing, and now incorporating stem cell therapy. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. I want to thank our underwriters today, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Davidson Orthopedics, Peak Art and Frame, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, San Francisco Design. And you've been listening to KPCW Park City. We want to thank our wonderful guests today, Josh Hobson, along with Darwin Louie and Parker Gunsel, who will be at Thin Air Park City.com next week. It's KPCW Park City.